Trapping on Public Lands Group based out of Montana. And so we're going to spend the next probably 45, 50 minutes talking to Anya. And it should be a really good interview, a really important topic, particularly with the wolf slaughter and the increase in trapping of traps and snares on public lands. So so nonetheless, let's play some music here, and then we should have the interview here soon. You're listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show, KRFP, Moscow. All right.
Welcome back to the
Wild Clearwater Country Show. I'd like to introduce our guest, Anya Heister with the group Footloose Montana. Anya, are you there? Anya, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling in and being a guest here on the Wild Clearwater Country Show. I know you're calling in from Montana, and you guys are an hour already ahead of us, so let's jump right into this. Can you please tell us, tell our listeners about the group Footloose Montana? When was the group created, and what possibly caused the group to be formed?
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, Brett, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to introduce our organization and, you know, tell people, your listeners, a little bit more about our efforts. So I really appreciate that. Yeah, my name is Anya Heister. I'm the executive director of Footloose Montana. We promote trap-free public lands in for people, pets, and wildlife here in Montana. And how we came about is basically a few things came together. First of all, I believe it was in 2005, beginning in 2005, there was a string of incidents that were highly publicized in papers and on TV here in Montana, where dogs were not only injured but actually killed in traps set on public lands, including one incident where a couple's dog was actually shot by a trapper, and that trapper stated later that he just killed that dog. He just shot the dog because he had gotten tired of trapping dogs. And so that was the first inclination for us that there might be something going on that nobody knew anything about, which actually turned out to be true later on. Secondly, there was an incident, I believe it was in November of 2006. One of my former co-workers' dog, a German Shepherd by the name Annie, was caught in a conibear trap, which is designed to break an animal's spine. And Annie got caught very close to a trailhead that my former co-worker had parked on. They just wanted to go on a hike that November day, and my coworker came back with a dead dog in her arms. And the tragedy of that incident was that not only did she not know anything about trapping, but she also didn't know how to open this particular type of trap, the conibear trap, which is a really massive device, or can be a very massive device. And so she ended up lying next on the ground, lying next to her dog, and waited for her dog for, I think, about 50 minutes to die, to suffocate and to die from a broken spine. So when I heard that incident, I just couldn't believe it. And nobody else could believe it. And nobody else could believe that trapping was still going on in Montana. And that is still true. I mean, Montanans, people who live here, probably as elsewhere in other states, just can't believe that trapping is still in practice, that trapping is still going on. So anyway, then after that incident, I had a personal encounter with finding animals in traps on several of my backcountry ski trips that I took that year. And I have to say, the sight of a life of an animal that still lives, but it has been in a trap for a long time, is absolutely horrific. These images, I had seen a pine marten hanging in the middle of the woods, caught in a leghold trap, just swinging back and forth in the wind in the middle of the woods. That animal was almost dead. I mean, it was just a horrific sight. That was one that really prompted me to start doing some research into the issue of trapping, and sure enough, some friends of mine and I, as we did some research, we found out that there is actually an official trapping program going on in the state of Montana, and that there is a year-long trapping season that never ends for certain species, certain predators, and certain so-called non-game animals with commercial values, and I can go into that a little bit later. So those incidents happened, and then, with a friend of mine, we wrote a letter to the editor writing against trapping on public lands. And from the responses, from the positive responses we got subsequently, we recruited a group of people who then met for several months, and we discussed what we could do. And then in March of 2007, another incident, tragic incident, occurred outside of the town where I live in Missoula, where a dog, a young dog by the name Cupcake, a young border collie, also had died in a conner bear trap. And his guardian, Philip, was so devastated by this incident. He joined us, and we formed, I think 4 weeks later, we formed an official nonprofit organization, and we called ourselves Footloose Montana. And like I said, our mission is to promote trap-free public lands for people, pets, and wildlife, basically aiming at an end of trapping on public lands in Montana via a citizen initiative.
All right. For those of you that are just joining us, welcome to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Today we're joined by Anya Heister, the executive director for the group Footloose Montana. They're out of Missoula. And Anya, let's jump right into the next question here. Could you please talk a little bit to our listeners about trapping or the lack of trapping regulations in Montana? What is the policy? And also maybe if we can expand on what wildlife species are there actually trapping seasons for?
Okay, yeah. Well, the general policy, to begin with your second question, is basically that it is legal to trap on public lands. Trappers need to ask for permission should they want to trap on private land. So we basically have two seasons, two trapping seasons here in Montana. One that covers so-called fur bearers, fur bearing animals. These are legally defined as beaver, otter, muskrat, mink, marten, fisher, wolverine, and bobcat, and swift fox, and lynx. For these animals, for the so-called fur-bearing animals, there is an official trapping season. It's called the Fur-Bearer Trapping Program, administered by our wildlife agency, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks. Now, it's also important to note that there is a year-long trapping season with no beginning, with no end, and that is for predators, for example, coyotes, weasels, and skunks, and for so-called non-game animals with, they're legally defined as non-game wildlife. They're basically termed animals with commercial value, and that is, badgers. I have to think, badgers, raccoons, and red foxes, I believe, yes. And so for these animals, they can be trapped year-round. And also important to note is while there are some regulations covering the trapping of fur-bearing animals, there are no regulations at all for the other two categories of predators and non-game wildlife. And so traps can be expected on public lands year-round. And it's feasible that, for example, a trapper sets a trap in the middle of a trail, and then when a dog gets caught or whatever, or when a fur-bearing animal gets caught, he can claim that he was trapping for predators, and nothing will happen to the trapper. No regulations apply to the trapping of these animals. You talked about, or you mentioned trapping regulations, or rather the lack of thereof, and that is actually very accurate. Trapping in Montana is a very lax, regulated hobby of few people. A total of probably 4,000 to 5,000residents of Montanans purchase a trapping license for a total of $29 every year. And that is less than 0.5% of the Montana population. When I say that trapping regulations are very lax in Montana, I mean that, for example, there is no mandatory trap check. Our Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, our wildlife agency merely recommends that trappers check their traps every 48 hours. Now, I have talked with trappers, or trappers have told me, that they cannot be bothered to check their traps every 48 hours, let alone every third day or even fourth day. What is feasible for them, maybe, depending on gas prices, is the family doing well, if something happens in the family, I just can't get out to check my trap line, so maybe once a week, maybe twice a week, and we have to think about what does that mean for all these animals lingering in extreme temperatures, lingering in traps for several days and nights, in traps, or snares, barely alive probably. They have to defend themselves against possibly potential attacks by other animals. They're absolutely helpless. They are in pain. They are suffering. They are undergoing psychological trauma. And so, coming back to regulations, I'm sorry, I'm veering off a little bit.
No, that's just okay. You're doing a great job. Please continue.
And traps set for fur-bearing animals, for example, like I said, bobcats and so forth, wolverines, fishers and so forth, they can be set 30 feet away from the center line of a public road. They can also be set 50 feet away from public roads. And so-called non-lethal traps, such as the Leckholz trap, and non-lethal snares, which are snares set horizontally on the ground that catches an animal's foot, for example, without necessarily killing the animal right away, can be set 300 feet away from trailheads. And lethal traps, including the conibear traps and lethal snares, those are snares that are set vertically to catch an animal's neck, to suffocate the animal, can be set 1,000 feet away from trailheads. So then the next thing is to mention, I think, is that there are only five quotas for five fur-bearing species out of a total of 16 species that can be trapped here in Montana, and that is the otter. They have a quota. Can I list the quota, or is that too much?
No, please, you can certainly list the quota.
Okay. And I can repeat that information again, if somebody has any questions about that. So the quota for otters, for example, is 95. And that, maybe I should mention that the state of Montana is divided into seven legal districts, and depending upon the district, there are varying quota for the species. But anyway, in any case, the total quota for otters is 95. Bobcats, I think it is a total over 2,400. I don't have the exact number of bobcats statewide can be trapped. Seven fishers with a subquota of two females. Five wolverines can be trapped in Montana with a subquota of one female, and I can explain that later if somebody has a question, and 20 swift foxes can be trapped in the state of Montana.
Now, I'm going to skip ahead and to a different question here. I'm referring to an article that I believe you were the author of that appeared in the Missoulian, November 15th, 2011. In that article, you mentioned that trapping is contributing, if not leading, a leading cause of the depletion of fishers, otters, lynx, marten, and wolverines. How do you know this? And outside of Alaska, do any other states in the lower 48 allow the trapping of wolverines?
Yeah. Well, your last question is also a great question. Actually, Montana is the only state in the lower 48 that allows trapping of wolverines, which is absolutely ridiculous. There are only a few individuals left, and the effective population size of wolverines is estimated by researchers as 35 individuals. The effective population size is basically the number of individuals that can potentially breed, you know, out of a total of, I think it's about 250 individuals that may be in the Rocky Mountain region. So how do we know that trapping is a leading, in most cases, a leading factor that leads to the depletion of, and probably local extirpation of species? Well, there are several studies that were done that show, for example, one study actually done by a Fish, Wildlife, and Parks employee who did his master's thesis on the fisher population in Montana, and who said that in his thesis that not only is trapping one of the leading causes for local extirpations of fishers, but also that the fishers had to be reintroduced twice already. And again, in the past, trapping had been one of the leading factors for the need to reintroduce fishers in Montana. The lynx, for example, the lynx is extremely vulnerable to trap sets for bobcats. And a lawsuit in 1997 actually forced the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services to consider the lynx under the Endangered Species Act, citing studies that I think it was 86% of the lynx mortalities were directly attributable to trapping.
Wow. That's a huge number.
So in 1999, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks was basically pressured, forced by the threat of a lawsuit to close the lynx season. Otherwise, they would have probably not even closed the trapping season on lynx. So the river otter, for example, are listed in Appendix 2 of CITE, under the species that, under CITE, that allows commercial trade in river otters only if it doesn't harm the survival of the species. And the U.S. Forest Service has declared river otters a sensitive species. Pine martens, nobody knows how many pine martens there are, and yet they are being trapped. There are some old studies that have shown that trapping is probably among the factors that contribute to or even hasten the local extirpation of pine martens in Montana.
Well, this comes as no surprise, and what I mean is that based on our experiences here living in Idaho and dealing with the Idaho Fish and Game Department, it seems like the Montana Fish and Wildlife Parks Department is just as belligerent and irresponsible when it comes to managing species, particularly predators or fur-bearing animals that might be on the brink of local extirpation, and their inability to manage the species according to the science.
I would agree with you, Brett. I would probably say that Idaho, and I'm sorry to say this, but Idaho is probably even worse than Montana, at least. And, well, actually, I don't mean that at least, but there are some regulations that, for example, setbacks of traps, and I believe, in Montana, and I believe there are none of those in Idaho. I think in Idaho, as far as I know, traps can be set anywhere, even in the middle of the trails.
Well, later on, I think in August, the Wild Clearwater Country Show is going to have Idahoans Against Trapping as a radio guest, and that's something that we'll jump into. But let me ask you the next question here, Anya, and this is getting back to the suffering. In that same article that you wrote on November 15th, 2011 in the Missoulian, and for those of you just tuning in, welcome to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Today we are being joined by Anya Heister, Executive Director with the group Footloose Montana. Anya, in that article, you mentioned that scientific studies show that trapped animals suffer from fear, anxiety, and physical pain, including dehydration, starvation, predation, lacerations, dislocations, and other stuff. Can you talk a little bit about some of these scientific studies that show just how much suffering, not only physically, but also psychologically or physiologically, that animals suffer when they're in these various traps or snares?
I think I've mentioned it before. Animals caught in traps or snares suffer from a physiological and also psychological trauma. And by that, I mean that scientific studies have shown that trapped animals, endure multiple degrees and various types of injuries. For example, studies have shown that animals caught on land, animals caught in leckhole traps, for example, suffer from broken bones, lacerations, torn ligaments, broken teeth. They suffer from even amputation. Some of the trapped animals and raccoons and muskrats are actually notorious for that. They end up chewing off their caught limb, or they twist it off, which must be, I think it is incomprehensible, the level of pain and desperation that would cause an animal to do such a thing.
Did you mention that there's a specific species that does this more often than others? What species was that?
I know that trappers have talked about muskrats primarily.
Okay, muskrats.
Chewing and twisting off their feet, yes, that are caught in leckhole traps. Then also studies have shown that, first of all, and if you think about it, that there is no, like I've mentioned, there is no mandatory trap check in Montana. That means, especially in light of high gas prices and so forth, that animals caught in traps linger out there in the woods in extreme temperatures. And I'm sure you know how cold it can get in Idaho, in Montana, in the winter at night. We had horrible temperatures, last winter. And these animals have to endure, lying there in pain and terror. I think that especially for a wild animal, there's nothing more frightening than being confined. And you can see that, that has been confirmed by trappers too, who have seen the destruction surrounding a trap location that held caught a wild animal, where that wild animal, a coyote, for example, had just absolutely destroyed the bushes around, just trying in a futile attempt to get away from the source of pain and desperation. And so studies like, I think the researchers are Gilbert, Waller, Prowse, have particularly shown that most types of traps don't even meet so-called basic humane standards, which would require traps to kill animals, or they would require animals to lose consciousness at 3 or less than 3 minutes. And if you, I guess I'm jumping ahead, and I am thinking about particularly traps set underwater for semi-aquatic animals such as beavers and muskrats, for example, and otters, for example. These animals, because they're semi-aquatic, they basically end up drowning in these traps. And mink have been observed in studies to struggle for up to 4 minutes before they lose consciousness. And beavers have been observed to struggle frantically, trying to get to the surface of the water to get air, to get oxygen, for up to 20 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, this current topic certainly is not for the lighthearted. I mean, just sitting here in the studio and listening to you, Anya, and for those of you joining us here, welcome to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. We're with Anya Heister, Executive Director of the group Footloose Montana, which is against trapping on public lands. I mean, a topic like this, it's hard. I mean, the first word that comes into play is just barbaric. I understand that the history that fur trapping and fur trapping fur bearing animals and the history, the deep history and role that has played in the discovery and the settlement of the West, but that was 200 years ago. And I do like to think, I think like a lot of other educated and progressive people, that we would start evolving, just like other species, that we would start evolving based on our experiences and our knowledge, including the studies that have shown, if not just from an ethical perspective, it's certainly tough to, you know, tough to even listen to. Anya, let's switch gears just a little bit here. And I want to talk about the Josh Bransford trapping incident here in Idaho. Certainly, that topic or that matter went global. It reached newspapers all around the world. Certainly, it was all over the U.S. here, all over Idaho here, and Footloose Montana was at the base of that situation. For those of you that might not remember, Josh Bransford was the Forest Service employee out of the Grangeville, Idaho area here that took a picture of a wolf that was still alive that he had trapped, and he had a big happy smile on his face, and then he decided to post it to the web, and then it went viral, and then Footloose Montana, I believe, posted a picture of that photo on your website, and then your group received a death threat or death threats. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, can I add something to what you just said, Brett, and the fact that wolf that Josh Bransford had caught in a trap. Well, not he didn't catch him, but the trap had caught that wolf, and it sounded and it sure looked like as if that wolf had been shot too, a couple of times by bystanders.
That is correct.
And when Josh Bransford was called by a coworker or friend of his or whatever. Somebody who told him that he got one in his trap, meaning he had caught a wolf in his trap, he then returned to the trap site and he had nothing better to do than posing in front of that tortured, suffering wolf in the trap. And I think that that image of a highly significantly suffering animal, especially a beautiful animal like a black wolf, you know, upset a lot of people, like you said, globally. And the photo that I found that I then posted, not on our website, but on our Footloose Montana Facebook page, was picked up by several newspapers internationally, and the image and the story that then a reporter wrote, and several reporters actually wrote afterwards, went viral. And So I posted this photo, several photos actually, that Josh Bransford had posted on one of the trapping forums that he posted on. I think it was on a Thursday when I posted it, and on Monday when I opened our email that we at Footloose Montana receive at our website, we had that death threat waiting for us, basically a threat geared towards us, calling us pretty bad names and basically saying we're next and, you know, somebody, the sender, was just waiting for us to suffer and he or she, the sender, would like to put a gun at our head and watch us suffer or something like that. To be honest, I don't even have the wording of the death threat in my mind anymore, but I can tell you, it was. I mean, I'm not easily scared, but it was very upsetting, very scary, to the point that the board immediately decided to forward that threat to the FBI and to a local sheriff department here in Missoula, and that's exactly what we did. The FBI took that very seriously, and they are, I think, still in the process of getting a subpoena to then contact Google and to get the sender's address and name and to find the person who sent us that death threat.
So the investigation is still ongoing?
Yes, apparently so. Yeah, it takes an awful long time, yeah.
Now, for those of you that are joining us here, we're speaking with Anya Heister, the executive director of the group Footloose Montana. They're out of Missoula, Montana. And Anya, we'll go to a very related topic here. The decision of the Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Commissioners to approve a trapping season for wolves in 2012-2013, there's been a lot of public backlash. And based on some media reports, it sounded as if the majority of public comments that were submitted for the proposal by Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, those comments, the majority were against trapping wolves, yet the commissioners, I believe, voted unanimously in favor of a trapping season. What's your opinion of the situation? Just what the heck's going on out there in Montana?
Yeah, that's a really good question. First of all, Brett, though, there are five Fish, Wildlife, and Parks commissioners. One commissioner, who is a Native American, decided not to vote. So it was not necessarily anonymously, but it was 4-0. The vote was 4-0. It doesn't,
okay,
in the end,
okay,
it doesn't make any difference.
Okay,
you know?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you're right about, I can't tell you how I know that, but I do know for a fact that the majority of the comments, a total of 7,300, by the way, that Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has received, that the majority of these comments were against the proposed, at that time, the proposed wolf trapping, and probably a lot of them were even against trapping altogether. So the fact that the commissioners then go ahead and approve the outrageous, aggressive proposal by Fish, Wildlife, and Parks is very telling for the political climate here in Montana, and I think it's indicative of what's going on here right now, which is, and this is my personal opinion, that I think that the political climate is currently, and has been for a while, dominated by extreme right-wing conservatives who are dominating the political debate. These organizations, these right-wing conservatives, have a lot of influence, apparently, a lot of power to influence, divisions that actually should not be based on politics, of course not. They influence and they dictate now even wildlife management decisions. What happened, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks had an extremely aggressive management plan that they proposed. And so I think what happened, the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks commissioners, who then approved that plan, that was, by the way, changed by the agency after the public commenting period ended. The Fish, Wildlife, and Parks had the audacity to increase the so-called back limit from one wolf per hunter-trapper combo, from one wolf that one person can kill, they bumped it up to three wolves. And they did that, they decided to do that, after the end of the public commenting period, which I find absolutely outrageous. I actually like to look into the legality of that decision. I just find it absolutely pathetic and outrageous for those of us who actually care about wildlife, which doesn't seem to be the case for the wildlife agencies these days. And then another interesting fact that you may would like to know too is that a local hunting advocacy group, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, recently donated $50,000 to the State Wildlife Agency. In their letter, to the agency, David Allen, the CEO and I think president of the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, basically requested that the money would help killing wolves at all means, by all means, and including aerial gunning, hunting, trapping, and even gassing pups in their dens. So what is happening here right now is that the wildlife agencies are caving into hysteria caused by conservative, extreme right-wing conservative organizations. And, and I think conservation organizations basically lost the fight because they were not dominating, they were not demanding, protection or preservation for wildlife, which they should have been doing. Instead, most of them take a very weak stance. You know, they are, first of all, for example, Defenders of Wildlife. Defenders of Wildlife is not opposed to trapping. They may have started out as an anti-trapping organization in 1949, but they don't seem to have any problem with trapping as long as it is, and here I quote one of their representatives, as long as it is done responsibly and doesn't threaten the survival of the population.
Well, I'm about to fall out of my chair here because everything you just said on this radio show disputes that claim that they're making or why they're justifying trapping.
Yes. I mean, certainly the decision to have a wolf massacre, as I call it, here in the fall and winter in Montana is not based on the best, so-called best available science. A standard that the Wildlife Agency actually has to adhere to. In fact, Jay Maloney, who is an independent, and that's important, he's an independent wolf biologist. He is not dependent on a salary from an organization, including the State Wildlife Agency. And Jay has reviewed the data on wolf numbers that Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has collected. And he has reviewed the collecting methods, and he has determined that the data collection methods are flawed and simply unscientific.
Yes, I'm familiar with Jay Mallory, and I'm familiar with the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, particularly just this past week. The big news has been that the Murie family, which is the godfather of wildlife biology, particular elk biology and elk habitat, Olaus Murie, of course, was that particular individual. Make a long story short, they sent a letter this week to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, demanding that they either change their extreme anti-wolf stance and rhetoric and or remove the Olaus Murie name from one of the most prestigious wildlife biology awards that Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation gives out, and of course, to no surprise, in a typical knee-jerk fashion, David Allen responded, "Heck no, we're not going to change our stance, and we'll just simply wipe the name off the award and call it something else." So, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation is no longer a conservation organization in my mind, and I think in a lot of minds for people that are paying attention, they've completely lost their way. It's a very disgraceful situation there, and as for Defenders of Wildlife, I don't have a whole lot of good things to say for Defenders of Wildlife. Not necessarily the individual. individuals that work for Defenders, but the Defenders has caved in a lot, particularly recently when it comes to wolf management in the Rockies, and so that's too bad. I wanted to talk to you about, we got about another 5 minutes left on the show here, Anya, and I wanted to talk to you real quick about the public trust doctrine. And can you explain to our listeners what this doctrine is? And maybe, has there been any successful litigation that has used the doctrine to stop wildlife hunting or trapping?
Yeah. Well, that's actually a great question. And I have to admit, Brett, that I'm not an expert on that particular topic. But I do know that the public trust doctrine is something that most people are actually not aware of. But it's hugely important, especially as for citizens concerned about current wildlife management methods. The public trust doctrine is basically a declaration with a long, long history. It covers so-called natural resources, including air, water, and unfortunately wildlife is included as a natural resource. I don't view wildlife as a natural resource, but anyway... that declaration, that public trust doctrine, covers these resources and states that these resources are held in trust by the government and being managed for the benefit for the public. So basically, it traces back to early Roman law. It was then when people recognized that certain things could not be owned by an individual, that they instead had to be owned collectively by society and civilization. So no individual human can claim property of air, of water, or of wildlife. However, when in the case of trapping, for example, that the public trust doctrine applies, but then as soon as a wild animal gets caught by a snare or a trap, or is otherwise immobilized, that is when a wild animal then transitions into private property, of the trapper, in the case of trapping. What's also important about to note about the public trust doctrine is, like I said, wildlife is considered a natural resource that is held by in trust by the government. For example, a state wildlife agency in trust for the public. So if a state wildlife agency acts against the will of the public in total, then I think there is an issue. You would think that there is some litigation regarding the public trust doctrine, but to be honest, Brett, I don't know of any, but I can assure you that Footloose Montana is looking into that potential.
Well, that's very interesting, and I appreciate you being honest with your knowledge of the subject, and certainly the public trust doctrine is just something that I've recently become aware of. I am not a lawyer. I do not know any of the case law involving the public trust doctrine, but from a common man or common woman perspective, when you listen to what the definition of the public trust doctrine is, and then you look at a decision, you look at the recent decision of Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and the fact that despite the majority of comments that oppose the trapping season for wolves in 2012-2013 in the state of Montana, despite those that public sentiment, they went the other direction and voted just about unanimously to implement the trap. You would think this is just what the public trust doctrine is about, what it's trying to prevent. So that should be very interesting. Now, Anya, we got another. It should be very interesting to see what develops concerning this doctrine, and if individuals or groups look into using it to stop the slaughter of wolves here in the Northern Rockies. Running out of time, we're joined today by Anya Heister with the group Footloose Montana. Anya, last but not least, how can folks learn more about the work Footloose Montana is doing? How can they get involved in your mission?
Oh, we welcome anybody who is interested in helping us, of course. We, especially because we're looking into the possibility of doing another citizen initiative, and we didn't even talk about this. We did a citizen initiative in 2009 and 2010 and gathered nearly 31,000 signatures in support of an end of trapping on public lands. Anyway, people can contact us through our website, which is www.footloosemontana.org, or if you are on Facebook, please visit us there under Footloose Montana.
Well, Anya, I'm going to say right here and now, you've been a tremendous guest. You're very well spoken. It's more than obvious that you have done your homework and then some. You're very knowledgeable of the trapping campaigns and the political situation and some of the scientific studies that are being produced in the Northern Rockies and in Montana. On a personal note, I'm certainly with you every step of the way, and I really commend Footloose Montana for the important work, in my opinion, the important work and necessary work that you are doing. Again, I'd like to remind everyone that Footloose Montana is about ending trapping on public lands. It doesn't go beyond that. And so therefore, in the climate that we live in, it seems like trapping and use of snares is only increasing because of the lightning rod wolf issue. And so it needs to be going in the other direction. I do believe that we need to end trapping on public lands. We certainly need to put a stop, an end to the wolf slaughter. So thank you so much for all of your great work and being a guest here on the Wild Clearwater Country Show.
Oh, thank you so much, Brett. And a big thank you to you and your listeners for allowing me to talk today.
Well, Anya, and you stay in touch. You take care and keep up the good fight. And go get some dinner, huh?
Okay, we'll do.
All right, there we go. That was Anya Heister with the group Footloose Montana. And tough topic. That's a tough topic to talk about. Pretty gruesome, but the truth hurts. And so it's certainly something that we cannot ignore, in my opinion. It's something that we must look in the eye and figure out what is the future of trapping on public lands in the West. And certainly later this, sometime next month, while Clearwater Country Show, will have Idahoans Against Trapping on here as a guest on the radio show. There's a group in Oregon called, I believe it's Trap Free Oregon. And then there's another group down in New Mexico, I believe that's Trap Free New Mexico. And so it appears that, now politically might be a different thing, but it appears that citizen groups are popping up more and more here in the West that want to see an end to trapping on public lands. And my hunch is that that's only going to gain further traction. And that's a good thing, in my opinion. So nonetheless, another big shout out to Anya Heister, executive director with the group Footloose Montana, and the important work that they're doing. Want to do a quick promo here for KRFP. Certainly Wild Clearwater Country is part of the KRFP Moscow family, and check out how you can become more involved in your community radio station at www.krfp.org. Stand by for this announcement.
Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Remember the 28th of July, because that's the date that KRFP will be showing the dystopian masterpiece, V for Vendetta, on the side of our engineer's barn at 1280 Lundquist Lane, right around dusk. This Orwellian-esque drama outlines how a man who dons a Guy Fawkes mask cannot be killed, because beneath his mask, he is more than flesh, he is an idea, and ideas are bulletproof. He uses his rage and abilities to raise the conscience of a future London, who realize that their government had been lying to them, and incites them to throw off their shackles and realize a better future. So in your future, remember to show up with a lawn chair, a heavy blanket, and some munchies, and be prepared to reconsider your safe little lifestyle with the rest of us as Mr. Fox takes out some very bad men. See you at the movies
this Saturday. KRFP.
And that's right. You were listening to KRFP Moscow, and good show today. Good show today. Really important topic, trapping on public lands. Good job, Footloose Montana. Keep it up. Let's give you a look at the weather report here. Tonight, mostly clear with a low around 53. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high near 89. Winds out of the northeast between 3 and 6. Thursday night, partly cloudy with low around 57. Winds out of the west between 5 and 7. Friday, 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms after 11 a.m. Mostly sunny with a high near 88. Winds on Friday will be out of the west between 5 and 9. Friday night, 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms. Partly cloudy with low around 55. Winds out of the south between 3 and 7. Saturday, welcome to your weekend. Sunny with a high near 83. Saturday night, partly cloudy with low around 57. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 83. Sunday night, mostly clear with a low around 55. And Monday, mostly clear with low around 50. Well, I say Monday, sunny with a high near 84. So ripping blue skies. I want everyone to have a great rest of the week. Enjoy your weekend. Get out into wild Clearwater country. Thank you so much for listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show. You can catch us here on KRFP Moscow every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. Please stand by for Between the Lines.
Thanks its donors and underwriters, including
Mikey's Gyros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine such as gyros, falafel, hummus, tabbouleh, and spanakopita. Located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
You are listening to KRFP Moscow.
We are now no longer the knights who say Nikish. We are now the knights who say
KRFP Moscow.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author Ron Jacobs, who talks about his recent article, Syria Through the Looking Glass, which examines the geopolitical conflict now being played out in Syria's civil war. Ladd Everett of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, who talks about the recent massacre of moviegoers in Aurora, Colorado, and the obstacles in Washington to restricting the sale of assault weapons. And Joanne Landy, co-director of the Campaign for Peace and Democracy, who discusses what lessons U.S. progressives can learn from Greek movements resisting Eurozone austerity measures. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
An investigation by the Guardian newspaper reveals two-thirds of U.S. food aid to starving countries is purchased from three mega food corporations, ADM, Cargill, and Bunge. ADM won half the contracts from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for food aid in 2010 to 2011, worth $300 million. Cargill, the world's largest private company, won $96 million in food aid.